Welcome to Searching for Bernie. I'm Alan Mayerson. For the past few months, we've all watched and listened as Bernie Sanders has campaigned on a platform that puts economic issues front and center. From income inequality to the minimum wage to the vanishing middle class, economics is the central pillar for Bernie's whole argument about why he should be elected president. Now, I majored in economics as an undergraduate, so I've been wondering, what would my former economics professors say about Bernie's ideas? How does democratic socialism, or at least Bernie's brand of it, how does that fit into an economic model that places free markets at its center? I graduated from Wesleyan University, which is a small liberal arts school in Middletown, Connecticut. And when I looked at the website of the economics department at Wesleyan today, well, most of the names were new to me, which makes sense because I graduated about 35 years ago. One name, though, jumped out at me, Richard Adelstein. Professor Adelstein's name popped out at me not only because I remember him as an extraordinarily popular teacher, but because I still regret that I never took any of his classes. It's a total screw-up by me. But then I realized I could partially make up for my mistake by calling him up now. If I could get him on the phone, he could explain what economists think of Bernie Sanders, and I could finally attend a seminar, actually more of a one-on-one tutorial with Professor Adelstein. A couple of quick notes before I roll the tape of our conversation. First of all, our talk runs about an hour, and I thought about editing it down, but then I figured I should give you the full benefit of an Adelstein seminar too. So if you want, you can listen to the whole thing. We talk about Bernie, of course, but we also go well beyond that to explore how economics has evolved, or in this case, in some ways, devolved over the past 30 years. You'll also hear why Professor Adelstein calls some of these changes bullshit, which is his phrasing, not mine. Second, Professor Adelstein doesn't like to be called Professor Adelstein. He prefers Richie. And to be honest, I had a hard time doing that. No matter how old I get, there are certain people who I'll never feel comfortable addressing by first name, and my college professors are among them. That said, Professor Adelstein insisted on Richie, and so I tried. Finally, a little background about Richie Adelstein. He graduated from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1968, earned a master's degree in teaching at Harvard in 1970, and a JD and a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania and its law school in 1975. He's taught economics and social studies at Wesleyan since 1975, and twice he's received the university's annual Binswanger Award for Excellence in Teaching. His academic interests lie at the intersection of economics, law, history, and philosophy, and in the historical development of social institutions and the problem of how social order is created and maintained. Richie is married with two adult daughters, and he's also a lifelong fan of the Chicago Cubs, all of which he says has given him a deep appreciation of the limits of reason and control. When Richie joined me on Skype, I asked him what he and his fellow economists at Wesleyan think about Bernie Sanders' economic ideas.
I think certainly the majority, not everybody, but the majority of people in our department would be lukewarm to something that they would recognize as democratic socialism or social democracy. That's a left, a European Labor Party sort of stuff. And most of the people in our department, I think, are not cordial to that, but that doesn't include everybody. But I went, and I, including myself, and I, you know, I have very strange feelings about all of this. My own personal politics are rather strange. But when I looked at Bernie, at the thing that you sent me to, Bernie's agenda,
right,
with the exception of the worker control, which I liked a lot, I'm a Lewis Brandeis fanatic, and mm-hmm. Lewis Brandeis was for worker control. I think everybody would gain by reading more Lewis Brandeis or learning more about him. But apart from that, almost all of the points on which Bernie is running on are, how shall I say, what did Howard Dean call it? The Democratic wing of the Democratic Party.
Right.
When I was a kid, which was 10 years before you were a kid, this is what every Democrat stood for. And that's what distinguished them from the Republicans. Not that the Republicans stood for what they stand for now, but they stood, generally speaking, for less state and more market, with the same general objectives as the Democrats. And there weren't any radicals around, because there really weren't any serious radicals in politics in either direction. And of course, now there are. But what Bernie seems to be saying is, look, from this platform is, you know, if this were 1964 and I were Hubert Humphrey, it would sound a lot like this. And listen to everybody else. I mean, as from where I sit, and I call myself a left libertarian, from where I sit, the president of the United States, whom I admire and voted for, is a liberal Republican, another species which is now extinct. And Hillary Clinton is certainly a liberal Republican, and all the liberal Republicans are Democrats, because all the Republicans are crazy.
I've made this point on this podcast a couple of times already, but I don't think Bernie is actually Hubert Humphrey from, you know, the 60s or early 70s.
More like the Hubert Humphrey of the 40s.
He's actually, as someone pointed out to me, he actually, if you read the 1956 Republican Party platform, yeah, much of what Bernie talks about is in that. He's almost an Eisenhower Republican.
Yeah. And here's a thought. I think I'm 68 years old. I was born in 1947. And much as it pains me to say this, since generally speaking, I despise the Republican Party, the best president of my lifetime was Ike. Mm-hmm. I sure would be grateful if we had a president who could do things that Ike could do, and the temperament to do them in the way that Ike did it. Ike came, when Ike left office, he gave that memorable speech about the military-industrial complex, and he was 110% right. And he tried, when he was president, to restrain the development of the nuclear arsenal. He didn't like it. He recognized the dangers of it, and he thought it screwed up diplomacy awfully. So he was a pretty level-headed guy.
So let's go back just for a second
to
all right. To Bernie and your colleagues'
right.
general lack of excitement okay. about him. So as the economic argument, not where your political right. loyalties may be, okay. but why, from an economist standpoint, is the European model the road to ruin?
It's not necessarily the road to ruin, and I don't think most of the professors of economics at places like Wesleyan believe it would be the road to ruin. But there certainly is a bias amongst professional economists, which has gotten much worse over my professional lifetime, which is a subtle bias toward the economic ideology of the Republican Party. And I don't think that this is because economists go into economics to learn this. On the contrary, I think most people, at least when I started, went into economics with just the opposite point of view. But what you learn as a PhD student in economics, which has changed somewhat since I did it in the early 70s, what you learn, subtly or not so subtly, in many different ways, I can cite a lot of chapter and verse on this, encourages you to think that two things. That economic efficiency is the primary public value, and that it's a sort of modern, technically dressed up version of utilitarianism, and it is the official ideology of modern economics, that is economics since 1870. And it has two propositions. One is that economic efficiency is the primary social value, and that economic policy should be made to secure the objective of efficient allocation. And the second proposition is that by far the best way to achieve economic efficiency under perfect conditions is through free exchange in markets with no dirigisme, you know, no direction or interference by the state, with the possible exception of some mild redistributing through things like negative income taxes. And so this produces, in economists, it produces a number of things, but ideologically and very subtly, without anybody trumpeting this, it suggests, number one, that economic efficiency trumps all other values in the economy. And secondly, that if you have markets that work well, let them be. And if they don't work well, try to fix them so that they do work well, and don't try to replace them with government allocation for efficiency, which almost every economist believes doesn't work well.
So you're kind of jumping ahead to something that I was going to get to eventually, but I'll get to it now. And that is, I think what you're talking about, and again, it's been years since I sat in an economic classroom, so forgive me if I get this wrong, but what we're talking about is Pareto optimality or Pareto efficiency, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea is that resources have been, I guess, generally allocated in a way that it's impossible to redistribute them, so that at least one person is better off and nobody else is worse off. That's what Pareto optimality is.
Yes, and that's exactly right, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. But
Where I was going to go with this was, I heard this quote again the other day, and I laughed when I heard it. But so in this whole argument, you're saying this is what economists are taught. This is the bias that they have in their teaching. Mm-hmm. So this is, I'm looking at something I found the other day online, but I guess in 1951, Nobel Prize winning economist Ken Arrow, Gerard Debreu, published a mathematical proof that perfectly competitive free market results in Pareto efficiency in the long run. So there is proof that free markets really do work. And of course,
Can I stop for just a moment?
Yeah, sure.
Just on its own terms, what you said, what they proved was that free markets allocate efficiently.
Right. So
proved that free markets work. They prove that free markets allocate efficiently.
Right.
End of story.
Right.
And what I'm suggesting is that economists have made the jump from saying free markets allocate efficiently to markets work when they allocate efficiently, or things are good when markets allocate efficiently.
Right. So the rejoinder to this is the optimal, you know, this is a quote from, I'm going to butcher his name, Amartya Sen, is that how you say it? Amartya Sen, the optimal distribution of resources might be perfectly disgusting, right? That's so his argument is that efficiency is really not the goal, or it could be one goal, but I think, this is Sen writing here, an economy can be optimal in this sense, even when some people are rolling in luxury and others are near starvation, as long as the starvers cannot be made better off without cutting into the pleasures of the rich. In short, a society or an economy can be Pareto optimal and still be perfectly disgusting.
And that's absolutely correct, and every economist would agree with that, although they tend to forget the implication of it. So let me suggest a better way to phrase the point that makes it clearer what Sen and every economist knows about this. If goods are allocated efficiently, Pareto optimally, then every good, every unit of every good is owned by the person who values it the most, which is a technical term, and which means the person who is willing and able to pay the most for it. Okay?
Okay.
And that's why nobody can buy that thing from that person, because nobody values the good as much as the person who owns it. So nobody else has the incentive or the means to offer this person enough to get the holder, what I'll call the highest valuing owner, to sell the good away. That's why it's efficiently allocated. So
So, but people who have no money have no way to express that
value.
Value.
That's exactly right. So I'd put it this way, in ways that are that make sense. Point: the efficient allocation that results from markets depends on the way goods are distributed amongst people before the market ever starts. So, as you accurately point out, if rich people like yachts or whatever they stereotypically like, and poor people like whatever they stereotypically like, then the economy will devote more resources to yachts, not because it's better to have yachts, but because the people who want yachts have the money and the desire to pay for them. But the people who want what poor people want don't have the money and desire. They have the desire, perhaps, but they don't have the money to pay for them. And so the economy doesn't register their preferences when it allocates efficiently. So if you were to shift the income distribution and you made people who were previously poor rich and people who were previously rich poor, then at least for a while, that the poor people would buy different things with their money than the rich people did. And that would be an efficient allocation too. It would just express the preferences of different people.
But you have to redistribute the income for that to happen.
That's exactly right. That's exactly. So what economists have forgotten is that caveat to the market's work.
The starting line.
That's right. And so as computer talk used to be, morally speaking, the efficient allocations of markets, what they do, are like garbage in, garbage out. You put in a perfectly disgusting initial maldistribution of income, and then at the end you get a perfectly disgusting efficient allocation of that maldistributed income. But if you start with one that's good, you know, where I have a lot of one good and you have a lot of the other, so we're not relatively poor or rich, then we can trade and we're both better off, and you get an economy where you have both efficiency and then in some sense equality or equity.
So again, to go back to Bernie, so Bernie would say, I imagine if he were sitting here with us, what we have now is garbage in, right? That the starting line is so skewed and it's gotten worse and worse and worse over the years.
Right.
That let's not rely on economists to basically the, you know, your colleagues to prescribe a path forward, because we're putting garbage in and all they can generate is garbage out, given this model and given the way they value things.
Right. So don't put in garbage. That's what every economist with the bias I'm talking about would say. So what economists have forgotten is the reliance on initial income of the particular terms of the efficient allocation. So Bernie says, well, the existing underlying income distribution is garbage. Granted, let's stipulate that. Well, change that initial income distribution and then let markets allocate it efficiently.
Who's talking there? Is that Bernie talking, or these are your colleagues?
These are my colleagues, at least my colleagues like myself, and if I may say so, Milton Friedman, who said this 60 years ago. He said, all economists know, if what Bernie means is that you're going to screw up the machine, the market machine that is producing this efficient allocation, and you're going to replace it with government doing in-kind allocation of what the government thinks poor people ought to have, then you won't get 40 economists, traditionally trained economists in America, to agree with that.
But he wouldn't. But he wouldn't say that. He would say, I'm willing to let markets do what markets do best, but we can all agree, looking at the data from the last 20 or 30 years, more and more garbage is going in. So my plan is to take action at the federal level to decrease the garbage level going in. Then we can talk about your markets.
So what do? You take money from rich people and you put it in the hands of poor people. End of story.
Yeah, but he can't say,
of course he can't say that.
Right.
But if I don't know what he can say or what he can't say, but that's what every economist would say the thing that would do the best for poor people in economic terms and would disturb the well-functioning economy, such as economists imagine we have, that would disturb the well-functioned economy the least would be not to go in there and have the housing off, you know, department allocate housing and the education department allocate education. It takes this point of view that the problem with poor people is that they're poor. It's not that they're stupid. It's not that their culture is screwed up. It's not anything other than that they don't have enough money. So the obvious solution is give them more money, and then the market will make whatever it is those people want. And then if there are still problems, then you know what the source of the problem is and that it isn't inequality.
So related question. I mentioned when we started talking, my son kind of wrote me into the Sanders campaign, and part of it was we actually over the winter watched Robert Reich had a documentary called Inequality for All. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I'd really seen it all laid out in one place at one time. Right. But the argument essentially is in the post, you know, since, starting in about the 70s, you know, the middle class has slowly been disappearing. So short question is, is that analysis accurate? Is that all of the talk about the disappearing of the middle class and growing income inequality in the country? Is it true?
Yes. So, and I think almost all of my colleagues would agree with that.
Right. So I've interviewed a guy who is essentially a Marxist, and we were talking about the fact that it seems to me, and I think it seems to him at some level as well, that Marxists are kind of getting a rehearing, at least in academia, in that the critique they've made of capitalism somehow seems more relevant today than it might have seemed 20 or 30 years ago. That the structural problems they see that will manifest themselves over time are more obvious today than they were 20, 30 years ago. Is that fair? Is that do you think that's fair?
I do think. We could talk for an hour about this. That the discipline has moved in my professional lifetime since 1970. The discipline has moved along a track that was clearly set in the two decades before that, and it's now become really quite a different kind of discipline than it was. It's not political economy in any sense any longer, and it is now economic physics.
So describe what the difference between those two is.
Well, political economy is about the great questions of, you know, distribution and justice. How should goods be made? How should they be distributed? Who should get what? On what basis? This is what every political economist from Aristotle forward through Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and people like and Karl Marx, this is what everybody was about when they did economics. It was the search for the answer to the great moral questions. And then economists in the 19th century saw the physicists, Maxwell and the Newtonians, and all the success that they were having in engineering, and they said, well, we can do this with social life too. And so they reduced economic life to simple equilibrium models. And economists have been chasing after this ever since. And for 100 years, the moral philosophy wing and the do it as economic physics wing, mathematical stuff, do it as science, so on, contended for dominance. And then about the time I was in graduate school, the moral philosophy wing threw up its hands correctly, thanks to people like Kenneth Arrow, and said, there is no moral science. Economists have absolutely nothing to say beyond what anybody else has to say about who should get what and on what basis should goods be distributed. Those are all political preferences. Different people can have different preferences. They can't be reduced to logic. And therefore, we as economists, as it turned out, won't be interested in that anymore. And so nobody was interested in that anymore. If you were 25 years old and going to graduate school and you wanted to study the great moral questions, you certainly would no longer go to an economics department. And indeed, for 40 years, it hasn't been like that. What you now go to an economics department to study are, well, up until 20 years ago, increasingly mathematically arcane, otherworldly descriptions of the world, of the social world, that you need differential topology to understand. And then, because none of those models is testable, and that's what all economists did, and they'd solved all the problems with it, that stopped being interesting, and people stopped doing what used to be called theory. Nobody does economic theory anymore. Now everybody does econometrics. Science means you need empirically testable algebraic hypotheses. If this goes up, then that must go down. But nothing in the social world behaves that way. And so over the last 40 years, the major trend in economics, it's overwhelmed everything else, has been the refinement of excruciatingly sophisticated econometric technique and the beating to death of huge quantities of meaningless data who can't be made to say anything conclusively or even suggestively. And the discipline is really quite sterile at the moment. It's in something of a state of crisis. And I think a lot of economists recognize it as being in a state of crisis.
So help me understand what I experienced as an undergraduate. I enter in 1977, I graduate in 81.
Right. I was there for the whole thing.
You were there for the whole thing, although, as I said, I didn't get a chance to take class with you. Wish, not listening to you now, I wish I had, my God. But were the, I think you call them economic physicists or something
Right.
equivalent to that, were they already pretty much running the shop at that point?
Yes.
They
Yes.
were.
But the old boys hadn't, like Bill Barber,
Right.
had yet been chased out.
And he was one of them.
He was not, no, Bill Barber was not an economic physicist. Mike Lovell was an economic physicist. Tom Whiten was an economic physicist.
And
But
Stan
Bill,
Liebergott was.
yeah, to an amazing extent, he was. He
Yeah.
was more of an econometrician.
Right.
He
No,
was really,
I used to do all his stats work. I was a
yeah,
research
I hated
assistant.
that stuff. He had the temerity. Everybody thought he, this is personal, everybody thought he was wonderful, but I didn't think he was wonderful. And intellectually, I thought what he was doing was barren. That is, he was trying to do econometrics and call it history rather than calling it econometrics. And that was a, he was part, an early proponent of what came to be called cleometrics, which was a bane on the history discipline for 25 years. So, yes, he was sort of like an econ. He thought that what economic history was applying these silly supply and demand models to things in history, as if this could be, things could be demonstrated in one way or another. But there were in those days people who didn't think of it that way. There was Bill Barber. Who else didn't quite think that way? Moore, Basil didn't quite think that way. But they were fading, as you can see.
How about Mike Jones? He was my micro teacher. He was a economic physicist, I
Yes,
think.
he certainly was. He
Yeah.
was, boy, he was there for 1 year as
Right.
a visitor. He was a PhD student at Yale.
Right.
And he's since, I've forgotten where he is, but he has since become, a serious economics professor. He was good then, and he's good now, and he's maybe 2 or 3 years older than you are. And so, yeah, that's what Barber learned. I'm an autodidact in economics, even though I have a degree, because my education is so bizarre. But apart from weird, bizarre people like me, they don't, the history of economics, the philosophy of economics, and normative economics, economics is moral philosophy, is not taught to graduate students. Or even to undergraduate students anymore. So I teach in the College of Social Studies at Western, and you remember the
Yeah,
CSS.
sure. May
Well,
I tell you a funny story?
sure.
So I graduated in 81, worked for a couple of years, traveled a bit. And I finally was able to articulate, about 3 years out of Wesleyan, all these questions that I wish I had had while I was still in school. So I called up Stan Liebergott and said, I want to come to Middletown and see you. He said, come on down. So I was visiting my parents in Boston, drove down, met him at like 10 in the morning in his office, and went through all my questions from day one of Econ 101, who is economic man, what drives him, what makes him who he is. And we went through, it seemed like 4 years of my education. We didn't agree on much. And at lunch, we took a break and we walked down to Marino's Market. I don't know if it's still there. And as we're walking down the hill, he said, take Mr. Marino as an example of economic man at work. You know, he creates a product, his sub sandwich. He sells it at a competitive price. He competes against the people at Sunshine Farms who were selling their sort of, you know, factory manufactured sandwich. And through the interplay of supply and demand and so forth, market forces, you know, a Pareto optimality is reached and so forth. And so he said, this is economic man at work. So we walk into the store, we go to the back, there's Mr. Marino. He looks up and he sees me and he says, my God, I haven't seen you in years. You know, how have you been? I said, my God, I can't remember you remember me, Mr. Marino. I said, how have you been? He said, well, I sold the store. He sold since you graduated. It's too much work, the pricing and everything. So right. I sold. And I said to him, well, what are you still doing here? I said, if you've already made your money and you've got a little, why aren't you playing golf in Florida? Why are you still making sandwiches behind the deli counter here? And he said, I'm here now for the same reason I've always been here. I love the kids, right? I love this community, and I just sort of feel like I got something, you know, something special here. So right. I nudged Mr. Liebergott, and I said, where's economic man? I don't see that sort of self-interested, rational, calculating guy who's out to, you know, maximize his own bundle of goods and that sort of utilitarian approach. I see somebody else, and he said to me, well, look at what Mr. Marino is doing, not what he's saying. You know, he's still
right, exactly. You know,
putting away his money and so forth. So
he sold the store.
Right, he sold the store. Look at what he's done. So we walk back up the hill. We eat lunch. And then I go afterwards to go see my government advisor because I was a double major in econ and government.
Who was that?
So that was Martha Crenshaw.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
So I go in to see her, and I'm clearly exasperated. I haven't seen her in years. And she said, what's going on? And I described to her what had gone on all morning with Stan Liebergott. And she smiled and started laughing. And I said, what's so funny? And she said, well, she said, our department and their department really never saw eye to eye on anything. And I tell you this long story because it was a revelation to me 3 years out of Wesleyan that this intellectual divide between the political scientists and the economists even existed. And I wonder just whether or not I'm not sure what the question is I want to pose to you, but there was some sense that I realized after I got out that really what professors are doing is trying to persuade you to see the world through their lens, that they're selling you a worldview of sorts that they've invested in and they've studied for decades. And they want to say, this is a reasonable and more and a truer way of seeing the world than the people who are upstairs teaching you all that political science nonsense.
And vice versa.
And vice versa.
Yes.
And I realize that's a long wind-up to the question. Is that a fair... I always assumed liberal education was like a giant Chinese buffet where you have a little mushy pork, you have some kung pao chicken, but you know, something more serious is clearly going on.
Something more serious is going on, and if you can see that and people are actually doing that, I believe that that's the optimal state for a university of any sort. That's what universities are supposed to do. And you'll notice that professors are not called teachers. And so their calling is not to teach. They're called professors. And their calling is to profess. And when you profess, you do exactly what you described. You're saying, I profess to believe that it is this way that is the best way to look at the world. And to some degree or other, you can't go through the professional training of becoming an economist or a political scientist or a sociologist, which is grueling and more grueling now than it ever was, without people do this in their 20s, and you can't do this under the conditions that graduate students have to do it without some serious commitment to just the sort of thing that you're suggesting. This has to be important to you in some way, so that when you're done and you wind up teaching, you profess. And everybody who is, every social scientist who is interested in social science is engaged in the questions that divide economists and from political scientists. But when you were saying that, here's the thought that flashed through my mind. When you were at Wesleyan, the divide was between the early nascent economic physicists in the economics department and the, I'm trying to think of people that you would know, the Clem Voses and the Schatzschneiders and the Bob O'Gormans.
Older guys.
Older guys who were sort of qualitative, normative, soft thinkers.
Right.
And the government department and the sociology department were dominated by the softer thinkers. After all, it's hard to do, you know, least squares regressions on Aristotle and Aquinas and people like that.
Right.
And that's what that was seen as, holding out the great virtues of knowledge and truth and liberal education against the technocrats in the econ physics department. So now there still is a divide between the government department and the econ department, but it's just like what's happened to the parties in America. The people who were the nascent model builders, the nascent economic physicists, who don't want to go any further than that and are sensitive to what the political scientists had to say, are no longer economists, they're political scientists. What remains of economics are the fundamentalists, the people who don't care about the moral questions in the least and are all about economic efficiency only. And the government department is increasingly dominated by the soft economists, so that more and more of what government departments do, more and more of the young people that government departments hire everywhere, not just at Wesleyan, are people who do what 40 years ago economists did.
Very interesting.
And I think that's happening everywhere in academia.
So I wanted you to take me back to, I think I had Econ 101 with Basil Moore, but I want to make believe for a second that you're teaching me Econ 101. I walk in first day and you're going to introduce me to economic man, Homo economicus. Right? Mm-hmm. Tell me about him. Who is he?
Okay, here's what I tell people. Well, it depends actually if I'm teaching Econ 101 for everybody, or our, which I do, or our version of the same course, Econ 110, which is for majors and is self-consciously supposed to be technically beefed up. That is, that it's more of a mathematical class than Econ 101. But your question is clearly about Econ 101.
I don't know. I think I want to get a sense of how economists think about economic man.
Okay. Well, the speech is pretty much the same. There are just different nuances, and we can talk about it if you like.
So do you do it first day? I mean, is this
first day? Literally.
Yeah, okay.
First day. Okay. So this is the first thing that they hear. We're going to study economics from the ground up. That is, this is a characteristic of economics and different from sociology. In economics, people think that everything that happens in the social world, everything, all of history, is created by the actions of individuals and their interaction with one another. There's no collective forces. History doesn't have any agency in the world. Nothing shapes human events except the behavior of individuals one at a time, in real time, in the present, for themselves and acting in some way, interacting with other people. And so I then say, so briefly, sociologists and historians and some political scientists believe that instead classes or the class struggle are in charge, or history or the Weltgeist are in charge, or race or gender or other technology or other kinds of abstractions, nations, are moving forces in history and the way things move. And economists deny this and reduce everything to individuals. And then I say, this is really the first day. In this course, we're going to start by looking at the individuals, which are the basic building blocks of everything. Then we're going to get into a hot air balloon. And over the course of the semester, we're going to go up 1,000 feet at a time and look down. And as we get higher and higher, we'll see more and more patterns of the interaction, but always on the ground, everything that we see is going to be created by these people. Okay, I'm almost to the end.
Okay.
So here's what the individual is, okay? And then I say, I emphasize this for the beginners and who are not economists. I say this is a caricature in the same way that a cartoonist can evoke Barack Obama in three strokes of a pen. This is supposed to evoke real people like you and me. And for the majors, I just move right to the math. I say, what defines you and me for the economists is that we are rational utility maximizers, which is a concept A of rationality of preferences, that you have to be able to say how much utility you get from everything in the world and know what you own and what you want and all of this other stuff. You know everything you need to know to make decisions. Your preferences follow rules of logic, and what you want to do is make choices so as to maximize utility. That's Homo economicus.
And the ledger is always a personal one. It's
basically
about you, the individual.
You. That's right. But it's not selfish necessarily. It's just whatever you want.
It's not selfish. Why isn't that selfish?
What you want is by definition selfish. Well, then selfish is not a pejorative. Suppose I love you, and the thing that makes me the happiest in the world is that you be happy. And so every time some resource comes into my hands, I say, I want to give it to Alan. That's what makes me happy.
Right.
Would you call me selfish?
I see.
I'm self-interested.
All right, so
what an economist would say and would insist on is just what you said, and that is, I'm doing that, giving you this, because it makes me feel good.
Right.
Not because I have some obligation.
It's not about you, it's about me, always.
Yes, that's right. From my point of view, making you happy is about me, and oh yes, it is all about me.
All right,
that seemed to me when I was 23 years old, and it was the first course I ever took in economics, was in graduate school. It was a graduate theory course, and this is what I gleaned literally from the first day, and I said, that's right. That conforms to everything I know about how human beings behave. Human beings, whenever they have a choice, will do what they want.
You know, I had exactly the opposite reaction. Was I sat in Econ 101, I heard essentially that description, and I went, you know, that doesn't really square with the way I get a sense of people. But you know what I'm going to do? It's the first day of my freshman year. What I'm going to do, raise my hand and say this is nonsense? I'll give it till day two. You know, let me at least sit in the class for a week and hear where this is going. And that was my strategic mistake, because by that time it's over. If you buy that, right, pretty much everything else follows. If you buy that assumption of what people are about and how history works, all the stuff you just said, then logically, a lot of it really follows from that premise.
Well, that depends on what happens in week three of the Econ 101 class. In my class, here's the difference between the two courses. In the Econ 101 for general ed, I teach 2 days on feminist economics and bounded rationality theory and anti-homo economicus. And then I talk about, you know, what good is homo economicus in light of all of these moral and empirical criticisms. And I don't say a word about that to the theory people, because that sort of stuff won't won't buy them a cup of coffee as econ majors.
I never met anti-homo economicus in my 4 years at Wesleyan.
Well, and that's because you never took a course from me.
I know. I'm telling you, this is my huge mistake. And it's funny, you talk about that.
That's why the students love it.
Yeah.
They have exactly the reaction that you have, because I agree with you. Economics, as you understand it, is loosely exactly what's taught everywhere, including Wesleyan, and you understand correctly that it is bullshit. And I understand correctly that it's bullshit. And I teach my economics courses with this underlying sotto voce message, that is, this is all bullshit. But before you're entitled to say that, you have to understand it crackerjack well. You got to know exactly what it says and exactly how it works, and then you're entitled to call it bullshit. And my students get this from the first day.
Well, it's great. You know, I think that, you know, after, 40 years in the academy, you're allowed to say bullshit, and you got protection for saying bullshit. And that really takes me to where I'm going next, which is, in your description of economic man, are all the members, I mean, everyone, all the people who teach economics at Wesleyan, they're all, you know, maximizing their own utility and trying to achieve, you know, looking out for their own self-interest, rational self-interest, are they not?
Yes.
So they're not...
Not just them.
Right, but they're not immune somehow. They don't stand apart from this model. They're in it.
Of course, yes. And I don't think, you know, to the extent that people are self-aware at all, of course.
So if that's the case, imagine, do you know any economists who had a road to Damascus moment at the age of 35 after going to undergraduate school and graduate school and doing all the things you have to do to get tenure at a university these days, who suddenly looks at the shift in in income distribution, or they've studied it long enough to basically say, my God, this is bullshit. But for me to stand up and say it's bullshit is to basically blow up my entire career. And therefore, evaluating the options in front of me, I've decided that the utility maximizing move here is to keep my mouth shut and to continue teaching these classes at places like Wesleyan University.
Well, I agree with that pretty fully, except at the very end. And that is, I'm sure there are such people, and they must be very unhappy, and they don't do any economics because they don't want to do what they correctly perceive to be the fraudulent economics that everybody seems to be doing. But they don't teach at Wesleyan, and the reason they don't teach at Wesleyan is that those people are intellectually dead, and they will stop being able to teach soon after they stop thinking. But at Wesleyan, unlike, say, Yale or Harvard or Princeton, where they teach graduate students, at Wesleyan, you don't have to do that. At Wesleyan, you can teach whatever you want to teach. I have no warrant from anybody, no expectation that my undergraduates at Wesleyan are going to be economists. I don't have to train them. This is a liberal arts institution. They're getting an education.
Ah, but I'm not talking about the way professors interact with their students. I'm talking about being a junior faculty member who's been studying this stuff for 10 or 15 years, who look at people, not you, Richie, but other people in the department, saying, if I speak up at this point, I am dead in the water. I am dead to these people.
Yes, I'm sure there are, and those people will not succeed.
Why?
Or if it happens to them when they're 35, they become deadwood. And I don't see people like that at Wesleyan. On the contrary, in order to get tenure, you have to be so good at doing something that Wesleyan will tenure you for that by the time you're good enough to get tenure, it's part of who you are and you keep doing it. Occasionally, mistakes are made. People are occasionally granted tenure for bad reasons, and they turn into the deadwood that you're suggesting. That is, they don't do anything. They're sort of alienated from intellectually from their discipline. I'm alienated intellectually from the discipline, and I just kept writing about something else. And what's so wonderful about liberal arts colleges is, since I don't have to train economists, I don't have to keep up with all this bullshit literature and teach it to third-year graduate students. I can talk about Aristotle to sophomores who are really interested in it and who are in my class because that's what they're interested in.
All right, and, so I don't want to beat this dead, but I got to try it one more time.
All right.
Let's say that I've been teaching as a junior faculty member at three or four different universities. I arrive at Wesleyan, I'm 31 years old or 33, I don't know. And I'm hoping I'm going to be a tenure track. And I'm teaching, I bought in and I'm an economic physicist. Yep. And I'm surrounded by economic physicists. And I come see you one day and I say, Richie, can we talk? And I close the door and I say, I don't believe this anymore. I've been trying for 10 years to convince myself, but I'm a Marxist, Richie. I just think this is noise. It just doesn't work. It'll never work.
And that is, somebody's personally come out of the closet as a Marxist. They right. were always a Marxist. And
No. They weren't. Are you telling me someone who actually...
No, in your hypothetical.
My hypothetical? No. They've actually had this Road to Damascus moment.
A life-changing experience.
Right. They've just gone, my Lord.
Yes. Such people must exist.
No, my question is, I come to you in this hypothetical and I say, Richie, what should I do?
Well, if you want to stay an economist, you have to do what you've suggested. If you're at a graduate department. If you have tenure,
that's my point.
If you don't have tenure and you want to get tenure, then that's what you have to do.
Do what?
Just what you're saying. You have to engage in the practice of an economics that you believe is sterile, that you no longer believe in, because that's the doctrine.
This is exactly my point.
Religion.
So this is just
in our department. It's in the government department. It's in the sociology department. It's in the physics department.
But that's, I guess, this Why, is without going too far afield from econ. Yeah. This is my question: is if the rules apply to you guys as well?
Yes.
And that you're constrained by these institutional and career and self-interested vectors that are pushing at you in all kinds of ways. Why should anyone believe what these professors have to say? Because they are they're not necessarily speaking the truth as they see it. They're speaking a constrained argument.
Of course.
That's a
what's the problem?
That's a huge problem.
It's only a problem if you focus on economics. And that's because, I'll send you something. If you have another 40 minutes, I'll send you a PowerPoint of a lecture I gave once on this subject.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
It's about what economists don't know, which Adelstein thinks is pretty much everything they claim to know, they don't really know. And at the end, I say, and this has all been terrible and dangerous for the world, because, and I put up their logo of the freaking Council of Economic Advisors. Somehow economists, unlike Keynes, who said it would be great if economists were thought of as competent professionals like dentists, economists have persuaded the world that if you put somebody like Ben Bernanke or Alan Greenspan or Larry Summers or somebody at the dials in Washington, you can make the economy jump up or down and make it do what you want to do. So no other social science has come remotely close to making anything like a claim like that. And the economists do it with mountains of data and with the nuclear strength mathematical models. And all of the models are bullshit and the mountains of data don't produce anything. But the economists always, just because they're self-interested people, just as you describe, and want power and influence, Ben Bernanke is the freaking man of the year for Time magazine. So imagine a presidential council of anthropological advisors. It makes you laugh. Who would think that an anthropologist knows enough to tell the president of the United States anything useful about anything other than perhaps a tribe in Afghanistan? Who could imagine a council of sociological advisors? And there are great sociologists in the world. What would they advise the president about? They don't have models to tell the president how to end income inequality or how to deal with failing education. They, they're social science doesn't come close to making claims like that. Only the economists, on the basis of this social physics and the econometrics, only the economists say, here's clearly what the policy ought to do, and here's a model that tells you exactly how to get there. And in 1946, they got the Congress of the United States to pass a law that said that there'd be a Council of Economic Advisors and that to advise the president to submit budgets that did macroeconomic fiscal policy. So it's as you can see, it agitates me.
I'm delighted it does. And I guess the question I wonder about is, I'm delighted you're at Wesleyan, and it sounds like you're standing up and calling bullshit, you know, on a, you know, somewhat regular basis, which is a wonderful thing. But I think, you know, you listen to Bernie and you listen to the Republicans, and the Republicans, with all of the tax cutting and the rising tide lifts all boats, and I'm old enough now that I've heard it for so long, and the data seems to be going in so much the opposite direction that it's laughable now when I hear it. But how do you break that vice grip of the economic physicists, that somehow there are these laws in play, and if we just get the markets right, things will work? I mean, how does the spell get broken at the national level?
I don't know how the spell gets broken, because it's obvious that important interests have an interest in maintaining this ideology. And there's a lot of money in national politics. And I'm of the school of thought that says that up until relatively recently, the Republican Party has governed through the Nixonian Southern strategy and, you know, governed for the plutocrats and done it through the instrumentality of the religious right and the white Southerners and the Reagan Democrats and people like that. I believe that the ideology that you've just described is perpetrated in an important sense by what Bernie calls correctly Wall Street, but, you know, it's obviously something different from just people who work in stock exchange firms. So that's the ideology, and that ideology is a cover for an attempt to use politics to redistribute wealth back to rich people who believe that they are people who would become rich under free markets, are the people who are best suited to govern things generally. And the one thing I think that any sentient economist knows is, and this is not the same thing that Thomas Piketty was saying, but it's something like that. Here's the lesson that I draw from economic history, and that is, when economic markets are allowed to run, to operate unfettered, when you have something like laissez-faire capitalism, no matter what the circumstances are, whether you're an underdeveloped primitive economy, whether you're a rising industrial economy, whether you're a mature industrial economy, no matter where you are, when markets are allowed to operate freely, they do two things, and that is, they produce enormous amounts of material wealth, that's economic efficiency, and they distribute that wealth in one way or another, on one basis or another, radically unequally. Because in the nature of things, markets will value certain traits, skills, attributes much, much, much more than they value others. And unless some brake is put on that, people who don't have a lot to begin with, they're going to get better off than they would have been, but they're not going to get any closer to the people who are better endowed. And as history goes on and culture changes, the things that mark you as endowed with the things that you need to become rich change over time. But the fact that markets will draw wealth to rich people in increasingly unequal amounts seems to be the way it is that capitalism works. I'm not a Marxist myself, and I think Marx was very confused about how capitalism works. But I think the general sketch that he drew, that it's an engine for increasing inequality unless it's somehow ameliorated. I think that's correct. And the other thing that's happened now, and this has began to happen in the Industrial Revolution, is that as more and more wealth is produced in a complex industrial economy, the flows of the wealth get to be larger and larger and larger. And so there are people in the economy who are able to put their thumb on the flows at critical points and divert the flows or control the flows. And because there is so much money in those flows, they're able, even by diverting a small part of it to themselves, to become fabulously wealthy, which is why the CEOs of the Fortune 500 companies make $35 million a year, because their companies are so big that $35 million a year looks insignificant in percentage terms to the amount of volume that's going through their companies. And as capitalism progresses, this also is predicted by Marx for incorrect reasons, there seems to be a lot more concentration over time, although it's much more complex than Marx thought it was.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I wanted to circle back a little bit to this Pareto optimality issue and this whole idea about, you know, the optimal distribution of resources might be perfectly disgusting.
The efficient.
Right, the efficient distribution. Well, actually, I think his quote is...
Yeah, whatever he said. He's talking about Pareto optimality.
Right.
But optimality is obviously a ridiculous term to use to describe efficiency given this qualification. I teach this in Econ 101.
Yeah, I think I'm reading a quote of his just...
You know, I'm sure you're quoting correctly, and I say economists shouldn't say things like that.
Right, so the disgusting part, the thing I found so compelling about the Robert Reich argument in general is it, although it's partly a moral argument, this is disgusting, this is wrong, we're a better country than this, all of that, he really makes the case that this kind of maldistribution, unequal distribution, is unsustainable, right?
Yes.
You can't keep the machine running with all the money concentrated at one end.
And that insight is Keynes's. And Keynes, I think a lot of the ideology of Wall Street that I was discussing a moment ago has contributed to the excommunication of Keynes. And it's, you know, that too is an interesting story in the modern history of economics. But
I guess my question is, how do you make sense?
Keynes was right.
Yeah. So my question is, you're sitting in the econ lounge with your colleagues, yeah, and they're all most of them are economic physicists.
Right.
And they wouldn't deny this particular law, right? Yeah. I mean, they would acknowledge that.
Right.
They may not like Keynes, but they acknowledge that piece of it.
Right. And none of them would ever be called upon to be an advisor to a president. Ben Bernanke is a great economist. I mean, he's an economic historian, which, excuse me, marks him out from 99% of practicing economists and knowing anything at all about history. He knows about the Great Depression. He has his own ideas about the Great Depression, but he knows a lot about it. And he is certainly aware of all of the nuances that we have been talking about. And he goes out and he does what he needs to do in Washington.
But come, I want to go back to the economic physicists, right? Who would acknowledge this system actually functions in a way that's going to create this inequality, and the inequality is unsustainable. So everyone's on board with that so far.
No, that's not true. I think everybody at Wesleyan is more or less on board with that. But there are large numbers of economists who teach at other schools who are not on board with that. And when the Republicans are in power, those people are on the Council of Economic Advisors. And when the Democrats are in power, people like Wesleyan professors are on the council. When the Republicans are in power and you look at the academic affiliations of the professors that they bring, they very rarely come from the stratosphere. They come from Alabama, or they come from Southern California, or they come from George Mason, or they come from Virginia or someplace like that. And when Barack comes, or the Democrats come, or Bernie comes, Bernie's people are going to come from Harvard and Yale.
So the argument of the people from Virginia and Alabama and so forth would be that this is not a systemic problem with capitalism, and that the problem really is just letting markets do their magic.
That's right. That's right. And I, you know, there are people like that, and I think even at schools, you know, where such, if I may call them such Republican economists predominate, as long as they're real professors with real PhDs, you could sit in a room and talk with them and probably get them to agree with some of what we're talking about. But I think that their ideological, the grip of their ideology on them is stronger than the grip of the Democratic economists' ideology on them.
Well, Professor Edelstein, I got to tell you, you got a great job because to be able to.
I do.
You do. I mean, the ability to kind of stand up and call bullshit on some of this stuff in the environment that you're in and beyond, yep, is a gift.
It's your alma mater. Give it $100 when they ask.
That's right.
It's a great school.
Yeah.
It's different than it was. It's never been, never been what it was when you were an undergraduate. It was like paradise when you were an undergraduate.
How so?
And the whole, well, Wesleyan kids were different. They were outspoken. They were critical. They were politically committed. They were gung-ho. They were like Michael Roth, who, you know, sort of walks around like King Claudius with Wesleyan blinking on his forehead.
Right.
He is Wesleyan. And all of you guys from the class of 77 to the class of 81, I think you're in the last one that was like this. It's a really, really distinctive approach to the world and a way of carrying yourself intellectually.
Oh, you say that to all the guys.
No, watch what I'm going to say. And at that time, Wesleyan kids stood at a particular point in the spectrum of left and right. Okay? So now here it is, 35, 40 years later, and Wesleyan kids still stand at exactly the same point on the political spectrum, left and right, and the whole spectrum's been shifted radically to the right. And so Wesleyan's a lot more like other schools than it used to be, even though the kids are still in this pole, not more toward the left pole. So it's really interesting. They're wonderful. I love them. And, you know, they're getting younger every year, but it isn't the way that it was before. And the economics is the largest major on the campus. And I would say 2% of the econ majors would be interested in the conversation that we are having.
2%.
That's why that's not why they go into economics. They go into economics so that they can get a job. They think of it as vocational training. And to an increasing extent, it is, insofar as the whole world's being controlled by statistics and big data. The economics majors come out of Wesleyan with very marketable skills, and they know it.
You know,
they're symbol manipulators.
Yeah, it breaks my heart to hear you say that.
Yep, me too. It's my employer. It's only your alma mater.
Right. you know, I have to ask you, and that is, you know, I was talking earlier about that sense that was only after I got out did I realize, my God, it's not a buffet. It's not just a little of this, a little of that, that you're professing, right? Almost like, I almost thought of it like...
But we're doing it right, we're professing.
When you're doing it right, you're professing. But I just wonder, I wrote this to Michael Roth on Facebook. He never wrote back to me about something that had come up at Wesleyan. And I said to him, I almost wish you, Professor Edelstein, or someone else would stand up at freshman year and say, here's what's at stake here. Here is the gauntlet you're going to run. And for the next 4 years, there are going to be people yelling at you like carnival barkers to come into their tent and be one of them. Mm-hmm. And these people are selling a very different basket of promises and visions and pictures of the world. And some of them are complementary and some of them are mutually exclusive. And some of these people don't like one another and will not speak to one another. There is a battle for your mind and your soul that you're going to be going on for the next 4 years. Be careful out there.
Right.
And I wish someone had said that to me freshman year, because the money I spent on the education would have been, the whole experience would have been much more alive to me if someone said that at the front end, instead of me realizing it when I was 25 and having to come back and see Professor Liebergott and say, now hold on a second here.
When you were a freshman at Wesleyan, I was teaching Econ 1. And if you had taken my class, the first thing you would have read was The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn.
Sure, sure.
Is that a book you've heard of?
Yeah, sure.
That
was
very good. That's what it's about. It's about
the paradigms.
Yeah, all the paradigm stuff. So people were saying that. You just had to be, that it wasn't everybody. And the direction of the whole faculty, the direction of academia generally, was moving away from that and toward, you know, increasing disciplinary fragmentation and drifting away from the great questions that used to unite thinkers in all disciplines into increasingly technicalized knowledge production. Don't get me started.
No,
it's been awful. Yeah. When you and I arrived at Wesleyan, Victor Butterfield had already made the decision to transform Wesleyan from a sleepy liberal arts college like Hamilton or Middlebury, which they all were at that time, into Yale, you know, Yale with liberal arts characteristics. And
but wasn't Vic Butterfield the...
He was the president.
But wasn't he the guy behind CSS and COL?
Yes. And his original idea was that everybody would be doing CSS or COL or something. The whole education, whole undergraduate education would be organized around the colleges.
Right. For the people, people listening, CSS is College of Social Studies and the COL is College of Letters, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. And they were supposed to be interdisciplinary. They were supposed to represent the liberal arts ideal. And at the same time, Victor Butterfield said, our teachers are going to be super professors. They're not only going to teach brilliantly, they're going to be doing cutting-edge interdisciplinary research, and it's going to be like Yale with small college characteristics. And so the faculty bought into the first part, but not the second part. That is, they liked the idea of becoming Yale, but they didn't like the idea of liberal arts characteristics because they weren't consistent with the way people could see the winds blowing in the disciplines. You weren't going to do well in the 60s and 70s and 80s in any discipline anywhere professionally if you were doing interdisciplinary College of Letters, College of Social Studies.
Because that was unserious and undisciplined.
Right. And you had to be doing technical political science or technical sociology or technical chemistry or technical economics or technical English criticism. And that trend was amplified all the way to the end of the 20th century. And it's beginning to break in the other direction. You mentioned that, you know, that there's an increased interest in Marx, which I think there probably is. But it's because of the sterility, not just of what's happened in economics, but what's happened everywhere, every discipline, I think, that's certainly all the disciplines at Wesleyan, the traditional academic disciplines, have all been rocked by similar kinds of crises to the one that I'm describing, even the sciences.
Richie, thanks a million for doing this. I really enjoyed it.
Let's do it again.
All right.
Stay in touch.
Take care, man.
Take care, Alan.
And speaking of economics, do you have any idea how much you'd probably have to pay to attend this sort of seminar with Richie Adelstein? Probably hundreds of dollars. But here on Searching for Bernie, It's a speciale, no charge for you. The only payment I ask is that maybe you could share this podcast with your friends, and if you have 30 seconds or so, if you could swing by iTunes and leave this podcast a nice review, that would be great. Reviews at iTunes help other people find this podcast. The show notes for this episode and a link to iTunes can be found at searchingforbernie.us. That's searchingforbernie.us. Thanks again to Professor Edelstein, that is Richie Edelstein, for taking time to speak with me and for helping me partially overcome my decades of regret that I never took a class with him when I was an undergraduate. And last but not least, thank you very much for listening.